life. In other words, go ask them. Okay, now, what do we say about that? Now, there's good eyewitness testimony. Well, the same type of thing, right? I mean, take the last one, Paul. Paul says there's 500 witnesses. Now, if we wanted to be skeptical, what do we say? Look, come by my car, my 1969 Chrysler LeBaron. It's a great car, has 520,000 miles of it on it, and I testify to you it's a great car. Oh, and I have 500 witnesses across the United States of America that can testify to it. I say, okay. I say, oh, by the way, they're gone now, and there's no way for you to contact them. That doesn't mean much, right? I mean, 500 witnesses, that sounds impressive, but that's taking Paul's word that there really are 500 witnesses. That's just his word that there are these many. So if you want to be skeptical about it, then what does this evidence show? That means we have four people, maybe five, maybe six, that actually are eyewitnesses, but that's what they say, right? Maybe, again, it was the collective psychosis, the collective psychological trauma that they went through. I mean, that's just not one of them. There's many other ways to account for them saying that. Just because somebody says they saw something doesn't mean that they did. And it may be that they believed it. And what's another possibility? Remember C.S. Lewis, right? Talking about Jesus. He's either a liar, a lunatic, or a lord, right? Not very pious type of language. His evidential is coming out, but you understand his point, right? We've talked about the disciples in those senses. They were either telling the truth or not. If they're not telling the truth, they're either lying or they were crazy, but they were undergoing some mass trauma, and so they believed falsely. So it's a possibility that we've looked at that. It's also a possibility they were lying. Now, does anybody lie to get certain things done? Do groups of people lie in order to do things? Well, of course, we know that happens all the time. People will lie to others, either as an individual or as groups. And you say, well, but the more people involved in the lie, the more likely that somebody will come clean later on. Well, there wasn't that many, right? I mean, the inner circle is 11, right? Some of the women, so you add a few more. But for them to maintain their conspiracy wouldn't be outlandish, right? Not outlandish to believe that. And even if somebody did come clean, felt pangs of conscience, I mean, okay, I've watched The Godfather way too much, but they have ways of dealing with people like that, right? Somebody has pangs of conscience, I think I'm going to come clean, right? We have ways, right? I have a pebble in my shoe. Is it my problem or your problem? Right? They have ways of dealing. So all that to say is we can explain this without having to say, yes, they must have seen Jesus rise from the dead. Okay, now, so we have these evidence. We can go on. The evidentialist has much more than this. Now, remember, though, what the problem is that he is arguing on the basis of what? The basis of just evidence. He's assuming some type of agreed-upon, neutral, autonomous view of the world, epistemology. We all agree, the unbeliever, the Christian, we can all agree on basic rules of evidence. And so given those basic rules, the evidence demands this verdict. Well, if you're not a Christian, you're going to take all that evidence and you're going to be able to give different spins on it and maybe spins that are much more probable. What does it depend on? Depends upon your perspective. Now, if your perspective is Islamic, you might be convinced of the evidence. Yeah, Jesus did rise from the dead. Well, does that mean they believe that the resurrected Christ is the Son of God? No, they believe that God has no begotten. So the evidence in some cases may cause people to believe it. If you're a naturalist, if you're an atheist, if you are a secularist, if you're a communist, if you are a Jew, is the evidence going to convince you? No, you're going to interpret it in such a way that will protect your privileged beliefs. You're not going to call your own privileged beliefs into question by this evidence. You'll interpret it in a way that conforms with your own way of viewing things. So the evidentialist wants to use arguments that he thinks everybody will accept. Right? Now, the only people that will accept them are, in the right way, accepting that not only Jesus rose from the dead, but that he is indeed the Son of God, are whom? Believers, right? That's why we hear these arguments and say, wonderful, right? We agree with them. Right? I mean, nothing that I said, although I'm trying to be critical to them, I'm not really holding those positions. I believe the evidentialist arguments. That's because I'm coming to it from a Christian perspective. Now, one more thing needs to be said, though. There may be another group of people that find these somewhat persuasive, and that is what? Unbelievers that God is, right, bringing about salvation. Right? We often think salvation is a momentary event. When, yes, it is, but God phenomenologically seems to sometimes, you know, have somebody go undergo a conversion season, right? They begin to make inquiries. I'm more interested in these things. You know, let me hear more about it. Right? And so people like that may be convinced by these arguments. But they're not really convinced by the arguments alone. What are they being convinced? How come they're being convinced of the arguments? Because they're beginning to do what? Think more and more and more like a Christian. And as they think more and more like a Christian, they're going to interpret the evidence more and more like a Christian. And the reason behind that is because if it's a genuine conversion, the Holy Spirit's working in their hearts. So, these arguments are arguments that are good from a Christian perspective. They're arguments that we find comforting, arguments that we find helpful to us. But outside of a Christian context, they're not convincing. In fact, they're pretty bad arguments for the reasons I gave previously. Why are they bad arguments? Well, especially if you don't deal with the religion or the presuppositions, the worldview of your opponent, they're not going to be not only convincing, but they're not even going to be minimally probable. If you're a naturalist, for example, one thing you're not going to conclude, the evidence could never get you to conclude, is that a miracle occurred. Right? For two reasons, right? One, the reason that is general, it's always more likely, or I could say almost always likely, and we believe this as well, it's almost always more likely that somebody is making something up, lying, or is deceived, than he is telling the truth about a miracle. Right? I report a miracle to you that happened on the way home last night, and I bet you cynics are not going to believe me. Right? You're not going to believe me. Why not? Well, you're Christians. You believe in the possibility of miracles, but you don't believe my testimony of a miracle for various reasons that we need not go into. But we typically take that perspective. How much more a naturalist who not only says it's not only more likely that somebody lies or is deceived about some miracle happening than it is actually a miracle happening, but they'll go on to say that it's impossible for miracles to happen. Because in a world that is all a matter of naturalistic processes, right, whether they be physical forces, electrochemical forces, just raw natural forces going on, there's no room for miracles. And so the naturalist is going to look at these arguments, and he's not going to be moved in the slightest. And he is right. He's right. He needs not be. We can't say, you're being irrational. You're not going by probability. Yes, he is going by probability. If a naturalist rejects these arguments for Christ's resurrection, he's being fully rational as a naturalist. Now, what does that mean we need to do then? Does that mean that he's okay as it stands? No. The problem isn't that he's interpreting the evidence incorrectly because of his naturalism. His problem is what? You all know this right now. What's his problem? His naturalism. His naturalism. Once again, Van Til. I'll discuss evidences and facts, but there's a point when we must start to discuss the philosophy of facts. We have to discuss the philosophy of the way the man thinks. We have to discuss his epistemology, his metaphysics, his ethics. And that's where we're going to show that he's faulty. Now, as a practical point, of a practical piece of advice, let's say somebody, you're talking to somebody and they say, you know, I know that Christians believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Why do you believe that? Now, what could you say in that at this point? What are some of the things that are you would come into your mind? Well, I mean, you may say, I believe because the Bible says it, right? And you can open the pages of Scripture and say, that's why I believe it. You could also say, and I don't think this is a compromise at all, because look at the changed life of the disciples. Look at the empty tomb. Look at all these things that we considered before. You scratch your head. You just said you shouldn't argue that way. No, you shouldn't argue that way as your apologetic. But if somebody asks you why you believe these things, aren't these true? Aren't these at least part of why you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Sure they are. So he's asking you why you believe these things. Now, is this ultimately why you believe it? Is that ultimately the reason? No, but he's asking you, give him some reasons. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes down to it, if he's being consistent with his non-Christian position, there's going to come a point where he draws the line and says, no, I don't accept that. And now you do need to do what? Bring out the heavy artillery, right? Bring out the heavy artillery. Now, does that mean we use evidentialism first? And then, you know, it's like the guys come, you know, we have our pistol and we shoot with our pistol and that doesn't work. And so finally we have to bring out a shotgun. So the pistol is evidentialism, maybe more like a pea shooter, right? But something like that. And then that doesn't work, so we bring out a flamethrower, presuppositionalism. Is that what I'm saying? No, I'm not saying we mix methods. We don't use evidentialism first and then use presuppositionalism as a last resort. Presuppositionalism teaches that we should use evidences. Now, most of you probably know this, but I'll have to say it again because for some reason it doesn't get through to many people. Presuppositionalism is not opposed to evidences. We use evidences. We like evidences. Evidences are our friends, right? I mean, we have nothing against them. We don't like evidential, say it, ism. We don't like evidentialism. So we don't start with evidentialism and conclude with presuppositionalism. There may be times when we start with evidences, and then we end up using transcendental arguments. But they're not two different tacks. They're part of the same apologetic methodology. Okay, so evidentialism is the view that we simply present facts. This is a problem because of the probabilistic nature of it. It's a problem because of the naivety of it. We all agree on the same things, believer, unbeliever, wrong. And it's wrong because it doesn't come to terms with the worldview nature of our belief system, the interpretive networks by which we come to know things. Now, we can add more reasons that we've gone over, but you know by implication from our earlier studies what else is wrong with it. It's not biblical, right? It doesn't teach the correct doctrine of Scripture. It doesn't assume the correct doctrine of human nature in the fall, right? It teaches that men are open, men can listen to the evidence, men can follow the evidence, men are willing to bow the knee to Christ. Evidentialism assumes all this, right? So it has all these philosophical problems, but at the heart of it, it has biblical problems. Why is it any surprise to us that Arminian theology teaches an evidentialist method of apologetics? They go hand in hand. Why is it, you know, we're going to deal with classical apologetics next, why is it no surprise that papers from a Catholic theology goes hand in hand with what? Natural theology. They go hand in hand. Okay, so these views go together. Now, I wish I could say that it's natural that Reformed theologians and apologists hold to presuppositional apologetics. And I'm not a sociologist, I don't know. I think more and more are becoming presuppositionalists, I don't know, I think so. But there's still a lot today that aren't presuppositionalists. Now, there's a good question. Why are Reformed theologians and Reformed apologists and Reformed philosophers not presuppositionalists? Well, we've already had our discussion of self-deception, so we'll just leave it at that. I don't know. Inconsistency. You know, it's beyond me, right? Now, I may be a simpleton, but when I became a Calvinist, remember I told you the first time I read Van Til? You know, I was, incomplete Calvinist at that time, but I didn't really understand what he was doing. This is not apologetics. This is theology in the mask of apologetics. But later on, I came in contact with somebody named Greg Bahnsen, who was introduced to me by a friend, and I started hearing this another way, right? And as soon as I heard it explained this is an example, remember, of Van Til's sometimes difficult, but Bahnsen is a lot easier, right? That was proved true in my case. When I heard it explained the first time, the coin just dropped. Like, of course. Right? Now, I don't want to be hard on people, but it's really difficult for me not to understand somebody who's reformed, who hears a good introduction, a good overview of presuppositionalism, and says, well, I don't know about that. Of course. Right? Of course you believe it. Of course that follows. Okay, so evidentialism. We've looked at the philosophical problems with it and the biblical problems with it. Any questions about evidentialism? We picked on it long enough for evidentialism. Okay, next issue is classical apologetics. Classical apologetics is not what you will read in Gerstner and Sproul's book, though they call it that. Classical apologetics is not a book about classical apologetics, at least not only a book about classical apologetics. They add to it a lot of evidentialism. And classical apologetics found its major proponent in Thomas Aquinas. Right? Thomas Aquinas is the premier apologist in the classical tradition of the Middle Ages. And we don't need to qualify it. Nobody has outclassed him today, although some have become more technically advanced. Thomas Aquinas was a brilliant, brilliant man. I mean, in an era where learning was very different from ours and impressive in their memory, this man had a memory like you wouldn't believe. He would stand at a podium like this and write out his compendious volumes. And he wrote as much as John Calvin. Okay. He wrote and wrote and wrote. And when he wanted to quote from the New Testament, he didn't go pick up a Bible. He went up from his memory. When he wanted to quote from the Old Testament, he didn't pick up an Old Testament. He quoted from memory. Now that's impressive. The Old and New Testament. When he wanted to quote from the philosopher, as he called him, which is Aristotle, he quoted from memory. Almost all of his quotations are from memory. Can you imagine that? This is a man who has a great capacity, a great mental capacity. Not only that, though, if you studied Aquinas, you'll see that his mind was very subtle and acute. The distinctions he makes, right? There's nothing, Augustine really does have a nice, nice discussion of God's sovereignty and human free will. And it is only improved upon by, almost 1,000 years later, by Aquinas, who, because he's able to make a few more distinctions, does. But he has a very subtle mind, acute intellect, goes to the heart of the matter. And this is a genius, right? Wish he was lived after the Reformation. Like, this would have been a great boon for us. But a great intellect. Now, Aquinas is the premier classical apologist. Now, a classical apologist is one who takes on the traditional proofs for God's existence. The traditional proofs for God's existence. Which are what? What are the traditional proofs for God's existence? Well, the main one, we've mentioned it earlier, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, the ontological argument, sometimes the moral argument for God's existence. Aquinas is famous for all of these except one, although he skirts around it in one of his ways, and that is the ontological argument. He doesn't forward the ontological argument. What medieval theologian was also a great thinker and a very good theologian. Which one is famous for the ontological argument? Can you tell me that? Anselm, right? Anselm is. Right? He's also famous for another work, Why the God-Man, right? Why the God-Man. So Aquinas doesn't hold to that proof, but he holds to the other traditional proofs. Now, to understand something about classical apologetics, you have to understand not only what these proofs are, but why they believe that these proofs are possible in the way that they are. And that the answer to that question, I mentioned this earlier, I'm sorry to repeat myself, but the reason for this is that they believe, these traditional apologists, classical apologists, believed in what we call natural theology. Okay. As a review, what is natural theology and how does it differ from natural revelation? I'm answering my own questions, but feel free to do that. Feel free to answer. I know it's late. I'll answer. Okay. Natural revelation is revelation, right? That God gives us, man, through his works of creation, providence. It's what God reveals himself to us by, right? Is there a problem with natural revelation? Of course not. There's a problem with us. Natural revelation does get through. Because of that, we are without excuse. We know that God exists. We know that he is wise. We know that he is righteous. We know that we will be judged by him, and righteously so. Natural revelation gets through, and we know this. That's why all mankind, except for Christians, or those with seared consciences, have a guilt complex. Because they are guilty. They don't feel guilty. They are guilty. And because they are guilty, they feel guilty. But there's some people that have seared themselves so much that they no longer feel guilty in any way. God forbid that that any of our family become like that. That's a scary position in. But that is natural revelation. God revealing himself to us in nature and providence, and that revelation getting to us. It gets general. It's also called general revelation because everybody gets it. Everybody gets it, no matter where you are, when you were born, what era. Natural revelation gets through day by day. The stars pour forth speech, right? The heavens declare the glory of God, not just at the beginning, not just at the consummation, but throughout eternity, throughout the history of the world. It's also general in its content, right? General in its content. It doesn't teach us about specific things about redemption. It can't give us the way of salvation, despite what people like Hugh Ross say, and I think, and I don't want to misrepresent him, but I read a few things by D. James Kennedy, and he seems to be getting awfully close. And I didn't read them extensively, but the little I read seemed to be getting awfully close to the gospel according to the stars out there. Okay? That's not our doctrine of natural revelation. Now, what is natural theology? Natural theology is not God's revealing himself to us. It is our building our way up to God by means of, typically, reason. We reason to God. We look at the world, and there is sometimes some natural revelation thrown in here. We look at the world and the things that God has revealed to us, and then we build up, by our own intellect, by our own reasoning, what God is like. God puts out the clues, and then it's our job to what? Put the clues together. Now, if you do it well, you're going to get the right answer. You do it well, you'll put all the clues together, and you'll see that it's Professor Johnson in the bedroom with the knife. Right? You'll get the right answer to the game. If you don't do it well, you're going to mess up. You're not guaranteed to get to the right conclusion. Okay, now, natural revelation is biblical. It's taught in chapter 1, section 1 of our Confession of Faith. Natural theology is not biblical. It's not reformed. And even though there have been some, indeed more than some, who have held to it in the reformed tradition, how they can hold to the Westminster Confession and believe in natural theology, I don't know, but some do. But it's not confessional, it's not biblical. But this view of apologetics assumes it to be the case. That's not quite fair. I won't say that Aquinas assumed it. They have arguments for it. They're not good arguments, but they have arguments for it. It assumes that version, assumes natural theology. Now, the main arguments, the cosmological argument, teleological argument, argue for what? God's existence. You take bits and pieces of things out there in the world, and then you put them together, and if you do it right through the deliverances of reason, you're going to get to God's existence. And perhaps more than that, perhaps you can build certain features into God. You're able to talk about, through these arguments, put in certain attributes in God. So you fill them out a little bit. Okay, now the cosmological argument, as I mentioned briefly in the frame discussion, is an argument typically about causation. Now, there's different versions to it. The Arabs, the Muslim Arabs, put together a version of it that is being studied quite a bit today called the Kalam version of it. It's interesting, but I'm going to give you the easier version of it. And that is simply that there are causes out there in the world, right? Every cause has to be every cause needs itself a cause. There cannot be any self-caused cause. So everything that has a cause needs to be explained in terms of another cause. And since there cannot be any self-caused cause, right, nothing can cause itself. By the way, that's not what we believe of God, do we? We don't believe God caused himself. We don't say that God called himself into being, right? It's impossible. You can't not exist and then call yourself into being. God is. So there is no such thing as a self-caused cause. Everything must have a cause, and therefore there must be an uncaused cause, right? There must be an uncaused cause. Very simplistic version of it, right? There cannot be an infinite number of causes. Otherwise, the series would have never got going. So there has to be a stop somewhere. And if there's a stop, it can't have a cause. It has to be uncaused. And we call that uncaused cause what? You answer that for me? That's not what Aristotle called it. Sorry. The Christians call that uncaused cause God. Aristotle called that uncaused cause the unmoved mover. The Muslims called that uncaused cause in their Kalam version what? Allah. Oh, this is somewhat revealing, isn't it? Tricked you, didn't I? We say it's God if we're Christians. Aristotle has his own deity. He calls it something else, and other religionists who believe this argument, who hold this argument, call it what they want to call it. Well, that should tell us something right there, shouldn't it? Okay, what it doesn't prove is God's existence, and it certainly doesn't prove the Christian God's existence. If it proves anything, it proves an unmoved mover. Moreover, it could not, well, be careful here, it could not prove the Christian God, the argument as it stands now, because the Christian God is a specific God who will suffer no rivals. But this conclusion allows for a, what? Free-floating conception of God, an undefined conception of God. And that is not compatible with the Christian God. Okay, so one of the objections to the cosmological argument in this very basic form, right? For our purposes, it's helpful, but it's very basic. I mean, there's books written on the cosmological argument, and some of them get quite sophisticated. If you're interested, William Lane Craig is a modern Christian philosopher who writes a lot about it, and he does some very interesting work, and he gets into modal logic, theories of time, temporal being, and things like that. So it gets quite heady soon, but the basics of it are always the same. And the objections to it are always going to be the same. It doesn't prove, first of all, the Christian God. Now, what's another objection that you can come to advance against it? That's a pretty good objection. So what does that mean? Okay, it doesn't prove monotheism. Because if there is one uncaused cause, Right? If you're going to accept that, why not two? Why not talk about the uncaused causes, yin and yang, right? Or dink and dork, whatever. Why not two? And in fact, there's good reason to think that there's two. The Zoroastrians thought there was good reason for two, and the Eastern philosophers think that there's good reason for two, the Taoist. Why? There's principles of goodness and principles of badness. Why posit a cause, a singular cause of all these different things, when you could say that there's a god of the good and a god of the bad? So actually, using this argument, there seems to be a good reason to accept two gods over one god. But since there are many things besides good and evil, right? There are trees, there are wheat fields, right? There's grapes, there are thunderstorms, there are oceans, there are clouds, right? There's things like marriage, like the hunt. Why not say that each one of those different types of things has a cause? Well, there you have what? You have the Greek mythology, you have the ancient pagan mythologies. Why not do that? If you're going to say that there's one uncaused cause, why not many? Now, there's nothing conceptually incoherent about this, right? These one uncaused causes don't, to say you there have an uncaused cause does not mean that that uncaused cause is absolute. Does it mean that there cannot be another one? So why not have more? Very good objection, right? This argument does not prove the Christian God. It does not even prove that there is a God. And it doesn't prove that there is, that it's a good argument, it doesn't prove that there's one God. It proves that there could be many gods. Very good. What other objections? What time is it? Okay. We'll find out about the other objections tomorrow.